You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
We've seen in these days a sort of permanent revolving door between prosecutors, judges, journalists, media, intelligence services who handle judicial documents or who handle prosecutors or who handle judges.
After allegations that Argentina's domestic spy agency was involved in the death of a prosecutor, President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner says she's dissolving the organisation. My studio guests, Jeffrey Kaufman of ABC News and Professor of History Kathleen Burke, give their perspective. Also on today's agenda, we discuss Obama's visit to Saudi Arabia, along with a gaggle of delegates as he pays his respects to King Abdullah and meets the kingdom's new leader. And Fidel Castro has spoken on the US-Cuba thaw. No surprise, he doesn't trust the US, but does still believe in a peaceful solution to conflicts, which is good news. And... Like that, loathe it. Either way, you'll love our music review coming up later in the programme with Monocle's resident music man, Paul Noble. That's all ahead here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very busy show in prospect then in the next 60 minutes. Before we start, let's get the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News with James Luckhurst. Auschwitz survivors have urged the world not to allow a repeat of the crimes of the Holocaust as they mark 70 years since the camp's liberation. Around 300 Auschwitz survivors returned for the ceremony under a giant tent. Some 1.1 million people, mostly Jews, were killed there between 1940 and 1945 when Soviet troops liberated it. A public inquiry into the death of former Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko has heard he may have been poisoned with polonium not once but twice. Mr. Litvinenko died from radiation poisoning in a London hospital in November 2006, nearly 3 weeks after drinking tea laced with the substance. Two Russians, Andrei Lugovoy and Dmitry Kovtun, have denied any involvement. Counsel to the inquiry, Robin Tan, QC, said the 43-year-old may also have been poisoned in October that year. Mr. Litvinenko had fled to the UK, where he became a vocal critic of the Kremlin and worked for the UK intelligence service, MI6. Robert Tan read out Mr. Litvinenko's dying statement in court.
You have shown yourself to be unworthy of your office, to be unworthy of the trust of civilized men and women. You may succeed in silencing one man, but the howl of protest from around the world will reverberate, Mr. Putin, in your ears for the rest of your life. May God forgive you for what you have done, not only to me, but to beloved Russia and its people.
Militants have attacked a hotel popular with foreigners in Libya's capital Tripoli, killing at least 3 people and injuring 12 others. Several gunmen stormed the Carinthia Hotel and opened fire in the reception area. A car bomb also exploded outside the hotel. Unconfirmed reports say some of the assailants have blown themselves up and that foreigners are among the dead. A Twitter account linked to Islamic State said it carried out the attack. Military sources in Ukraine say 9 Ukrainian servicemen have been killed in fighting Russian-backed separatists in the past 24 hours. The news comes as rebels fight to encircle a key town straddling transport routes between their 2 strongholds. Family members of 2 Australians who are facing execution in Indonesia visited them in prison today. Muran Sukumaran and Andrew Chan, 2 of the so-called Bali Nine, were found guilty and sentenced to death for attempting to smuggle 8 kilograms of heroin from the resort island to Australia in 2006. Clemency pleas by both men were rejected earlier, prompting the Australian government to call on Indonesia to reconsider its decision, as the 2 were reformed characters who had helped rehabilitate other prisoners. Their lawyer, Todung Mulya Lubis, says President Joko Widodo rejected their plea without knowing about their reformed behaviour.
I don't think the president knows, you know, what happened there. I don't think the president aware, you know, what changes that's been taking place. So if you read the rejection of clemency, you know that this is only a kind of formality.
A blizzard has swept across the northeastern United States, dropping more than a foot of snow across Massachusetts and Connecticut. However, its impact on New York City fell short of dire predictions. The governor has lifted travel bans imposed yesterday, and the subway system has restarted. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, eu sou London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, 13.06 in a slightly less snowy than feared New York City. Joining me with their take on the news of the day here in Studio One of Midori House are Kathleen Burke, Professor Emerita of Modern and Contemporary History at UCL in London, and Jeffrey Kaufman from ABC News. Welcome both to the programme. We'll start in Saudi Arabia, where President Obama headed today to pay his respects following the death of King Abdullah and catch up with the new Brune, King Salman. In tow, a 30-member delegation with top officials and Republican foreign policy veterans, a clear demonstration of the importance of the US-Saudi alliance. So, is this union a rational, reasonable consequence of realpolitik, or a meeting that must surely be watched with at least one raised eyebrow? And will anything change given this succession? What about the headlines surrounding the jailing and flogging of activist blogger Raif Badawi? Jeffrey, we'll start with you, perhaps, first of all. Obama cut short his visit to India, of course, to head to Riyadh. What do you think the dialogue will be like? All pleasantries, that kind of thing?
Oh, I think all the dialogue with leaders in that part of the region is based on pleasantries. The elephant in the room is always issues of freedom, human rights, absolute rule. I mean, I'm just simply not seduced by these men in their robes and their thrones. They are dictators. You know, they may be called kings and emirs, but they are dictators, and these are dictatorships. And, you know, we're going to talk about Cuba in a little bit. I covered Cuba for 10 years, and I always said if Cuba had oil, the U.S. would have wonderful relations with Cuba. I mean, there's so much that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia stands for that it just goes against American values, but they have so much oil and so much influence, and particularly at this time of instability in the region, any stable player, practicality rules.
Kathleen, what about on that point? You know, okay, there's practicalities in terms of oil. There's certainly practicalities, as Jeffrey suggests, there through stability. But one of the things the US is supposed to get out of this relationship is apparently intelligence. And that doesn't appear to have often served the US particularly well in the past. You think back, you know, going back, what, almost 15 years now to events of 9/11, this sort of thing. Does the US get enough for it to warrant continuing with things as they have been for such a long time?
Well, of course, how do we know? But they certainly think they do, in which case the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And it never does much good to tell dictatorships what to do. You do it for your domestic audience. You don't do it to make much have much effect in the country which you're at that point you're speaking to, the emir, the ruler, the dictator, the president, or whatever you want. It is a relationship of hard ideas, hard knocks, hard practicalities, as Jeffrey said. That's a very good description of it. It's a question of balance of power in the region. It's a question of keeping certain borders reasonably safe. It's a question of ideally trying to restrain or trying to hem in Iran, which it is not very successful at this point. So the thing is, we don't like it. It's not a good thing, strictly speaking, but it seems to me ridiculous to say that we oughtn't to do it because it's not a nice thing, because in terms of world power, geopolitical, the worst, the next best, the enemy is the best of the worst, it's a necessary relationship. Who else is the U.S. going to talk to out there? Is it going to talk to Iran? I don't think so. So therefore, except for Israel, which has its own problems, it's the major ally of the United States, and we just have to get used to it.
And is that the same dynamic back home? Is it politically tricky for President Obama or his predecessors to sustain this relationship? Or you just think people are, you know, they look at it in those cold, hard terms. They're very sanguine about it within the U.S.
I shouldn't have thought the U.S. looked much at it. It's one of those relationships that is important to those who are interested in defense and foreign policy and indeed Washington politics. But does it run in Kansas? I don't think so. I think it's a fairly risk-free relationship.
It struck me, Jeffrey, it was interesting what Obama said when pressed about whether he wouldn't raise the case of Raif Badawi while he was there. He suggested he probably wouldn't. And he said, what I found effective in dealing with relationships with nation states of this type is to apply steady, consistent pressure. I mean, is there any evidence of that with countries like Saudi Arabia when it comes to human rights?
Well, I think Kathleen's right. I mean, you speak openly for your domestic audience. You just annoy the heck out of them when you speak openly to their face, and at least in public. And there is so much going on in Saudi Arabia that is just repugnant to Western values. The stoning of women, the brutal lashing of this blogger till his skin was festering and bleeding, and this is to happen week after week after week. Women can't drive. I mean, these insane fundamental rights. But, you know, if we've learned anything in the last 10, 15 years, it's that changing regimes because you don't like what they stand for can lead to something even worse. And we've seen that in Afghanistan. We've seen it in Iraq. We're now seeing it in Libya. So you know, Saudi Arabia is just too big to play that game, and nobody would ever contemplate it.
It's interesting, one place where we haven't really seen that is in Syria. And of course, the Saudis and the US are perhaps loggerheads on this point, because the Saudis are very firmly behind the belief that, you know, until Assad goes, you can't deal with the threat of IS. They're in sort of union with most Gulf Arab states on that point. Do you think there's a bit of a foreign policy impasse, if you will, between the Saudis on that point?
Absolutely, because the Saudis distrust Iran. Iran has been backing Assad, and the US is now talking to Iran about a nuclear deal, and all of that scares the heck out of the Saudis, and perhaps with good reason, because some counterweight would be useful for the U.S. and the West, and you know, there are a lot of arguments for figuring out a way to talk to Iran, because when you look at what Iran is up to, if you take the nuclear issue out of the equation, it's hard to say that it's any worse than Saudi, and so it would be very, very useful politically for the U.S. to have two counterpoints in the region. It would not be so useful for the Saudis. And it is important, by the way, to look. The most interesting character is not King Salman, but the deputy crown prince, Mohammed bin Nayef, who is the first of the grandsons of the founder of Saudi Arabia to be named a successor to the throne. He's number two in succession. And he is a man who knows Obama. He is younger. He is healthier, and he has a very assertive foreign policy for Saudi Arabia, including crushing the Muslim Brotherhood. This is a man who really is actually much more interesting and ultimately much more important to the U.S. in the long term than this interim king, who was himself very frail.
Indeed, a more longer term than one might imagine, because, I mean, I agree with everything Jeffrey said, and the fact that he works very closely with the American intelligence system, and he's been doing this for 20 years. But in terms of domestic stability in Saudi Arabia, he has no sons. And therefore, there's no question of him trying to move for his own family reasons. In other words, he has a reputation of being honest, man of integrity, man who works extremely hard, man who has a very close relationship with the United States, a man whom you know what he thinks. The drawback is that he also tends not to back reform very much. But in terms of the possible link for the United States, it could hardly get any better.
Just on that point that you mentioned vis-a-vis Iran, Jeffrey, obviously Iran, a Shia state, the Saudis are Sunni. Is it a problem if the US does make any progress in terms of talking with Iran, even if this very slow-moving dialogue inches any further forward, especially on the nuclear question, could that prove to be, you know, a sort of a bridge too far, if you like, for the Saudis in terms of their relationship with the US? Or do you think they're as pragmatic as Washington, D.C. is?
You know, a bridge too far. No one controls everything in geopolitics, and I think the bridge too far that's going to be problematic if Iran is welcomed back into the international community is that it's also a massive producer of oil, which is currently facing sanctions. And what, right now, as we know, the market is glutted, prices have fallen through the basement, and the last thing Saudi wants is yet another competitor for low priced Middle Eastern oil.
Let's move on. We're going to talk about Argentina, the latest twist in a drama that's seen the death of a prosecutor and large protests in the capital, Buenos Aires. President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner has announced plans to dissolve and reform the country's domestic spy agency. The beleaguered president's move follows the death of prosecutor Alberto Nisman earlier this month, just before he was due to testify against senior government figures. He'd been investigating the deadly bombing of a Jewish center in the Argentine capital that killed dozens back in the 1990s. What do you think, Kathy, about how Argentina responds to this? Well, I guess it's a crisis and it's dominating Cristina's sort of farewell, you know, her last political hurrah. Is there any chance that she can extricate herself from and her government from the sort of tentacles of this intriguing scandal?
Well, she's put herself on the side of right in this particular case by saying that they've, you know, it's all the fault of a deposed excuse me, head of intelligence, by saying that she's going to do something about it. It's interesting, though. I mean, this whole thing was set up by Perón back in the 1940s, of course. And it's the same organization as was in place and afterwards when the junta were in power in the 1980s. So in that sense, she says that there hasn't been enough change, that a lot of them have been gotten rid of. But if you think about what's happening right now, in terms of the poor journalist who broke the story that there was something fishy going on and he was found in a pool of blood in the bathroom and so forth, he got the hell out of there, but he was tracked. He discovered that he was being watched by a man in blue jeans with a blue jean jackets wearing Rayburns. So obviously it was an agent. One can obviously tell there's a uniform there, I guess. But the palace, the presidential palace, actually tweeted what his journey was. They say, well, if someone's running away, we ought to know where he is because to keep him safe.
Extraordinary development, wasn't it, that they would get involved in that respect?
Yeah, I mean, it is the most amazing situation. It's the sort of thing that's going to make us sitting, you know, on the edge of the seats to find out just what's going on, because there don't seem to be any good people here.
Well, I think that nobody's really sitting on the edge of the seat outside of Argentina. It is an incredible story. As a journalist, it is so compelling. But, you know, the reality is no one really cares. Argentina has floundered. Argentina is perhaps one of the greatest calamities of the 20th century. It had so much prosperity, so much hope, so many resources, such good education, and yet, you know, it remains mired in corruption, nepotism, and incompetence. And no better example of that than Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. And how crafty of her. She was being accused of striking a backroom deal with Iran, oil for beef and grain in exchange, defying sanctions. And that was part of what was going to be revealed by Nisman, who the next day, and there he is found dead. And there she is saying, oh, no, you know, it wasn't a suicide. He was killed, but he was so naive and it wasn't me and I'm not guilty. And so I'm going to dissolve the security agency. Nice deflection, ma'am. Mm. I don't think you can't trust this woman. She and her husband before her have done everything they can to ruin Argentina and what little hope it had. It is just a terribly sad place. I have been there many times covering it when I covered Latin America. It is a wonderful place, and you the first time you go there, you go, oh my gosh, it's as grand as Paris and so sophisticated. But you don't have to look far to realize that it is some post-apocalyptic Paris, and there's this sense of poverty and decay.
I mean, it's extraordinary. I mean, Kathy was talking about this, the way that the SI, this agency, had survived through the transition to democracy in the 1980s. I mean, we'll talk about Cuba and these ideas of transition and normalization a little later. How is it possible that a body like that can survive through generations? Is it because there is endemic corruption? It's so entrenched that these institutions become inured to the changes that should ordinarily come from without?
You know, the country's never really recovered from Peronism. I think the statistic, as I recall, was that in 1900, Argentina had the same GDP and prosperity as Canada, and that the two countries were on the same trajectory. Peronism came along and really just put the brakes on it. And the country has lurched from one form of incompetent leftist government to one form of incompetent and brutal rightist government, the military junta that Kathleen talked about in the 1970s and early 80s. You know, Menem tried to reform the economy and failed. Whether he was incompetent or just shackled, it's impossible to say. But this latest episode is just, it's so distressing, because here was a kind of truth and reconciliation happening to the evils of the biggest terrorist attack in the history of Latin America, the attack on the Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires, 85 people killed. We've never really had a clear answer. Iran's connection to it has always been more than simply something talked about. And finally, we were going to get the possibility of some answers. And here he is, the investigator, murdered.
Just one point I'd like to make about, you asked why no one got rid of this organization. Could I propose that perhaps the heads do just what J. Edgar Hoover did, which was to make sure he had a file on anyone who was coming in, and then, you know, sort of saying, I have a little list, and therefore it was too dangerous for them, whoever came into power time after time, actually to do anything about them.
It's also, though, Kathleen, very useful to have these. You know, if you are only a marginal Democrat at heart, it's very useful to be able to discredit your enemies. And, you know, Clarín, which is the big newspaper group in Argentina, she's actually saying that Clarín is involved in the murder of the prosecutor. I mean, it's, forgive me, but it's a stretch.
Absolutely. That's the view of Jeffrey Kaufman and Kathleen Burke, who are my guests here on Midori House. When we return after a short break, we'll be talking about Castro and Cuba. Stay tuned.
As the day draws down in Europe and the next morning begins in Asia, the Monocle Daily is on hand to bring you up to speed with a one-hour programme packed with news, business and the best culture and design stories from around the world. Our presenting team in London are joined by guests in Monocle's New York and Toronto studios.
There's lots that the U.S. and the international community can do, but it's enfeebled by its diplomatic and political shortcomings.
And as the sun rises from Tokyo to Sydney, we'll take a look at some of the more interesting front pages landing on doorsteps across the region.
The authority of the Chinese Communist Party has been challenged on its doorstep in Hong Kong, and they do not like it.
That's the Monocle Daily, every weekday at 2200 hours London time, in association with UBS.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Edwards. With me, my guests today, Kathleen Burke and Jeffrey Kaufman. Now, after a notable silence, Fidel Castro has given his view on the recent thaw in relations between Cuba and America. "I don't trust the policy of the US," he said, "nor have I had an exchange with them, but this does not mean a rejection of a peaceful solution to conflict." So, other words of a 88-year-old ex-leader, much of a surprise, and to put it bluntly, does anyone really care what the current president's big brother has to say anymore? Jeffrey,
yeah,
do you?
They do. I can tell you. I'm sorry to keep harping back to my time, my decade covering Latin America. Fidel Castro he may not be a good man, but he is a superstar and a rock star when it comes to that pantheon of leaders of the 20th century, and arguably the last surviving one, Queen Elizabeth not really being quite the same power center that he was in his country. So there is a fascination. There is an absolute obsession with Castro. Of course, since he stepped aside after 49 years in power, you're right, he is diminished. But the mere fact that, you know, the kind of dead or alive game that goes on with Castro, the number of times I covered the announcement of Castro's death and the celebrations in Calle Ocho and 8th Street in Little Havana in Miami, and people going, "Yes, he's dead, hooray, finally." And of course, hours later or days later sometimes.
Reports
he would appear.
Were greatly exaggerated.
But it is interesting. You know, this goes against everything that he stood for. But you got to give the old guy credit. He recognizes times change. And, he's saying, it's not something I particularly like, but if it means if nations aren't at war, that's a good thing. It's a pretty enlightened comment from an old dictator.
Could I ask you a question, Jeffrey? Do you think that Raul Castro, that Fidel tried to stop his brother, or that he knew he didn't have the power to do
so? No one really knows how compos mentis Fidel Castro is and how much the two speak. It's such a secretive power structure, and his health has been so frail. He's obviously claiming authorship of this article in Granma, the Communist Party daily in Havana. So one assumes, well, assume is a bad word. It would be acceptable to think that he might have written it. There's no evidence he's died, although there were yet again more rumors. I think he called Diego Maradona to say, "I'm alive."
apparently, that's the new way
But this is a big deal. I have to say, I spent so much time going back and forth from the U.S. to Havana as a reporter, and I really began to wonder, I hope to have quite a number of decades left on this planet, and I wondered whether I would actually live to see a rapprochement. So I think in its small way, this is a huge story.
Kathy, let me just ask you, I mean, you've obviously got a deep understanding of, you know, sort of contemporary history, particularly with regards to the United States. 50 years of hostility, Jeffrey's been describing this fascination, particularly from, you know, that side of the, you know, of that body of water. Is there any precedent for undoing, you know, that entrenched relationship that's based on so much suspicion and so much hostility? Or do you think this is ploughing, you know, new territory for all concerned?
China. The U.S. didn't recognize China from 1949, when the People's Republic came into being, until Nixon in 1971-72. That really turned over, and only a right-wing Republican could have done it without being lynched.
Yeah.
And indeed, if one once again go back a bit further, the Soviet Union, it didn't get recognized until 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt recognized it. So the interesting thing about this one, I think, well, there's many interesting things, but one interesting thing is that except for Florida, on the whole, no one is really bothered.
And I think, having lived a decade in Florida and in the heart of Cuba, the Cuban-U.S. community, Cuban-American community, the generational change, we've talked about this before around this table, but there's been a big generational change. The original Cuban exiles, as they called themselves, who used to toast and say next year at Christmas in Havana, they really did. And they slept with the deeds to their homes underneath their mattresses. I mean, these are not urban myths. I've seen them. That generation is mostly died out. You now have second and even third generation. And you have the post Mariel Boatlif, the 1980 flood of Cubans who came over for economic reasons. They were not political refugees in the same sense as the 1960s and 70s arrivals. And those people want to see their families. They want to go back home and visit, which they can do. But they don't support this hardline sort of Neanderthal position that has so dominated Cuban American relations. And when I first started covering Cuba, an old Cuba hand said to me, "Understand one thing. When you're talking about Cuba in the U.S., it is not foreign policy. It is domestic policy, because those Cuban Americans have been so powerful."
Just a final thought, Kathleen, on that. I mean, some of the member of the U.S. delegation before the visit said this normalization of relationship, they're very keen to suggest it wasn't a reward for, you know, advances made by Cuba. It was squarely in the U.S. national interest. And to pick up on what Jeffrey was just saying there, that's how it plays at home. It's in their best interest. It's not any kind of, you know, diplomatic largesse that's involved here.
No, they're... Forgive me. There's hoping that the Americans will be able to invest. It's going to make a lot of younger Cuban Americans happy to go and see grandma. But also, it's going to be good for the U.S. not to have what they see as a haven of enemies 90 miles off their border.
And what will it look like, Geoffrey? I mean, just to sort of... to pick up on your years of experience, you talked about this, that gives you an advantage. What does this change really look like on the ground? Is it golf courses left and right? I mean, that's what people fear, that it will change the very fabric of this great country.
That is, one of the things, I have so many friends and acquaintances and colleagues who've gone to Havana and asked for advice, and I always, and I have to admit, I'm no different. The first time I went, my jaw dropped. It is spectacular, and it really, all the things that you say... that I said on that first visit, I regretted saying once I began to understand the politics. Oh, there's no McDonald's, there's no plastic signage, and no horrible prefab buildings. There's no Home Depot, but the price people have paid. I mean, it's just such a naive and really wrong thing to say, because of course, isn't that sweet for us? But the price people have paid in terms of lost opportunity and lost human rights for half a century is just enormous. That said, I think the most dangerous thing for Havana is a rapid opening, a soft opening to American dollars and capitalism is the only way to protect the rights. I mean, what I worry about are all these people who stayed in Cuba and their children and grandchildren now, who live, six families in a house built for one. That the owner of that house lives in Miami. He or she may not be able to claim the house back, but I've heard people say this: I will just give them whatever money it takes to get them out so I can get my family home back. And they say it with spit spewing from their lips. I mean, there's a real concern that Cubans could become guests in their own homes if the massive amount of American capital and the massive wealth of the Cuban-American community goes in there and just pushes them aside. I think it's quite likely to happen nonetheless in some form. It just may be a gradual process. But if it can be managed, then there might be some protection for the interests and the opportunities of the Cuban population.
Geoffrey Kaufman and Kathleen Burke, thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Монако 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Дете е Монако 24.
Лондонист, Нью Йоркист, Токио. Се е Монако 24.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Монако 24 дес.
Лондино, Нью Йорк, Токио.
This is Monocle 24.
It is 18:32 here in London. There's plenty still to come in the second half of today's programme. We'll be taking a look through Brazil's weekly printed press in just a moment and get a view of The Italians from the writer John Hooper, plus an Icelandic superstar, a libertine, and more besides. It's only the Midori House Music Review. Monocle's Paul Noble will be here with us with his tips for what you should be listening to. Before all of that, though, let's get the latest news headlines from James Luckhurst.
Auschwitz survivors have urged the world not to allow a repeat of the crimes of the Holocaust as they mark 70 years since the camp's liberation. Around 300 Auschwitz survivors return for the ceremony under a giant tent. A public inquiry into the death of former Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko has heard he may have been poisoned with polonium not once but twice. Mr. Litvinenko died from radiation poisoning in a London hospital in November 2006, nearly 3 weeks after drinking tea laced with the substance. Militants have attacked a hotel popular with foreigners in Libya's capital Tripoli, killing at least 3 people and injuring 12 others. Several gunmen stormed the Carinthia Hotel and opened fire in the reception area. Military sources in Ukraine say 9 Ukrainian servicemen have been killed in fighting Russian-backed separatists in the past 24 hours. The news comes as rebels fight to encircle a key town straddling transport routes between their 2 strongholds. And a blizzard has swept across the northeastern United States, dropping more than a foot of snow across Massachusetts and Connecticut. However, its impact on New York City fell short of dire predictions. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, James Luckhurst. More news from James at the top of the hour. The next full bulletin is coming up at 1900 London time. 1834 right now, you're with Midori House, and we're going to take a look at the weekly publications in one part of the world. Today, Tuesday, we're opening up the printed presses of Brazil, and helping me to peruse what we find there is Monocle's own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, welcome.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm very good. You're always so cheerful, Fernando, and you're a vision in electric pink today. I feel I should paint that picture for our listeners.
Well, thank you very much. And we're going to start actually with an electric cover as well.
This is bright and beautiful. Tell me a little bit about Epoca.
Well, Epoca, you know, is the second best-selling news weekly magazine in Brazil and potentially my favorite. I say potentially because I change time to time. And they have, first of all, it's written, "The Summer That Is Melting Brazil." So before we talk about who is on the front page, actually. So basically they're saying, you know, it's a record heat. There's an electricity shortage, higher prices for oil, higher interest rates, you know, lack of water, of course.
We've talked about this over the last few weeks, haven't we? Yeah.
But at least, you know, on the brighter side, they're talking about which mask is going to be the sensation of Carnival, which of course is a huge moment, in Brazil overall. So basically it's going to be the mask of Nestor Cerveró. You might ask, who is he? It's interesting. He's the former director of Petrobras, which is our national oil company. And of course, there's a huge investigation happening at the moment.
A lot of claims of scandals and all of this kind of thing. And where does Nestor Cerveró, where does he stand in this? Are there suggestions that he is maybe not a whiter than white character?
Well, not even suggestions, you know, it's been proved and he's arrested, he's in jail at the moment. And I have to say as well, why he became such a figure, of course, you know, he was a former executive of Petrobras, but he also, I mean, we shouldn't make fun of that, but he does have like a lower eye than the other one. You know, he does look like, a little bit like a caricature. But it's interesting because my favorite comedian in Brazil, José Simão, he says, I mean, we usually don't make fun of this, but, we can make fun of him because, you know,
He's a bit of a villain.
He stole some couple of money, you know.
And so we should actually, again, we should paint this picture. The cover then is this sort of cut out and keep. It's got the little scissor marks to cut around.
Exactly.
It's the mask of Nestor. Will this be popular, Fernando?
It will.
At Carnival time?
Will
people sort of get the joke?
Because I think Carnival is so important in Brazil that I think people tend, for example, I remember in 2001, I know it was not very good taste-wise, you know, but Osama bin Laden, everybody was wearing a mask of Osama bin Laden.
So it's kind of
when Obama was elected.
People will reflect on the news of the day. It's a satirical comment. It's
absolutely
something that's topical as well. That's not necessary. It's not just all traditions. They like a bit of...
And it's not all in Brazil as well. As I say, you know, we had Barack Obama, we had Osama bin Laden, whoever's in the news. And this year, you know, corruption and Nestor Cerveró.
Nestor. And he'll still be languishing in prison, will he, at that point? He won't even get to see.
I hope so.
Everyone in his masks. Hilarious. Fascinating stuff. Let's move on. Which is the next title you've got for us? For
again, I'm sorry, but I'm still going to talk about the heat, actually, Tom, because, you know, it is a record. You know, I was in Brazil and it was, you know, of course, you would expect a Brazilian summer to be hot, but this time is at record levels. And on Veja, they have a very interesting cover, quite striking, actually, picture of a tap and there's a lamp attached to it. So basically, they're saying that you know, Brazilians, they don't have water and they don't have electricity as well. There's been shortage of both. And basically inside, but, you know, talking a little bit on the funnier side, inside Veja, they always have the Veja São Paulo. And this week they had like a guide, how to survive in the summer.
You know, what are some of the tips? Have you had a browse of this, Fernando? What's recommended?
I do like clothing, you know, and they're saying how to stay elegant when it's 35 degrees. That's very difficult, you know, because you want to just take it off all your clothes, but, you know, you still have to work. So, for example, they hired like some stylists to comment. We always talk about that, but they say shorts are allowed, but she mentioned that you have to wear a belt with it, which I don't disagree.
You know all about the etiquette of shorts, Fernando. We've talked about that on Monaco 24 several times before. Where do you stand? A belt? Is that a...
I don't think so. I think you might be end up looking like a daddy taking his children to Disneyland, you know? So you have to be careful with that. So I don't think a belt is totally necessary.
I think you need to get in touch with these guys and get the Fernando guide to shorts etiquette for the summer.
And you know, shoes etiquette as well, because sandals are allowed, but flip-flops never.
Okay. And is this in the office or just generally speaking?
That's in the office.
Yeah. I think that's fair enough, isn't it?
I think it's kind of, yeah, I think that's fair enough. You know, you never see me with flip-flops coming to work, Tom.
So that's in the office. What about at home? Any tips for how you know, let's say, for example, you're entertaining, you would ordinarily be offering people maybe a tea or coffee. Are all bets off
when it comes to that? We have good coffee, but, you know, please do not serve coffee in this extreme heat. So basically, you know what they suggested? You put a scoop of ice cream inside the coffee. Easy.
I like that. See, that's a classic Brazilian solution to
a problem,
hot beverages on a warm day. Fernando, let's move on and talk about your final selection. Tell me about this one. What's on the cover here?
It's a very interesting cover from Isto É, because I don't even think we covered that yet here on Monaco 24, but it's about death penalty. It's on cover Isto É. And you say, why death penalty is on the cover suddenly? Well, basically, we had a Brazilian on the Indonesian death row, and he was executed on Saturday. last Saturday. So it became quite a controversy in Brazil because President Dilma asked Indonesian President, you know, Joko Widodo, she said, please don't do that. You know, she asked for a pardon and it didn't happen. Mm. So basically the relationship between Brazil and Indonesia is quite strained at the moment. And of course, the magazine was very critical of what happened as well and saying that, the crime rates in Indonesia remains high, even though with the death penalty. But there's another side to it as well, because they did a poll in Brazil, and apparently 43% of the Brazilians actually agreed with the Indonesian government. They said, you know, he was drug trafficking, he knew he was going to a country where, you know, he could be potentially...
This was a sanction that existed, right?
Exactly. So I think it's quite divided, actually, the Brazilian. I would say a little bit more than a half are against that. But, you know, it's 42% is quite a high number. And they even, there's just a little curiosity. The last time a man died of death penalty in Brazil, which was back in 1855, he was a farmer, a very rich farmer, who apparently killed 8 people who was working their property. But a few years later, it was discovered that it wasn't him. So
very much like in this country, a few high-profile miscarriages of justice, it's enough to... end the use of the death penalty.
And we have another Brazilian action on the death row in Indonesia, and apparently I think it might happen this year, so it's going to be very difficult between Brazil and Indonesia.
Fernando, that was a fascinating summary of the weeklies out of Brazil. Thank you very much for coming to share your wisdom and insights with us here on Monocle 24, and I can't believe you even talked about shorts wearing again. I don't know how you do it. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll hear from a writer who's been taking a close look at Italy and its inhabitants. Stay tuned.
From her perch in Wan Chai, Aisha Spears is Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief. Covering topics ranging from territorial disputes to urban upsets, the luxury goods sector to organic farming, Aisha Spears boasts one of the best beats at Monocle.
From the expanding political influence of Beijing to the growing economic power of Southeast Asia's middle class, we look at the people, businesses and nations that are shaping the exciting Asia-Pacific region.
From Sukhumvit to Orchard Road, Aisha Spears is Monocle's woman in Hong Kong and beyond. Catch her reports and check-ins around the clock right here on Monocle 24.
This is Midori House. I'm Tom Edwards. It's 1842 exactly here in London. Now, Italy, a country at once beautiful and baffling, rich in architecture, cuisine, culture and history, yet often ridden with paradoxes, not to mention, of course, its particular brand of politics. In his new book, The Italians, John Hooper delves deep into the unique character of the country's people, looking behind the stereotypes to explore modern Italy and its current condition. A little earlier, John joined Monocle's David Pleasant here in Studio One at Midori House. David asked him how he avoided falling into the stereotype trap.
Wasn't so much, I think, the stereotypes. I think the problem is the country is so diverse that every generalisation that you make, you're going to have to make an infinity of exceptions. One of the things I noticed when I was writing the book was that often when I consulted Italians about something, they would say with great confidence that such and such was a certain way. And then you go to another Italian who maybe came from a different part of the country who'd say nonsense. What you said was the first time was correct. And so that was a huge challenge. And in the end, I suppose what I did was just to dodge it. What I did was to say, right, I'm going to make generalizations based on what is generally true and leave it to the Italian readers to take away the exceptions. And there are many, many times in this book that I think that Italians reading it will look at it and say, well, that doesn't apply to my area. That doesn't apply to my family. And that's true. But I think as an outsider, you can probably see better often than the people of the country what is generally true.
Do you think if you can kind of conclude any kind of lasting observations, very difficult question, but kind of reading the book through, that there's a sort of negative twist or a slightly cynical dimension to it, would you say, kind of flavoured with this optimism and the sort of some of the joys and the things that we all love about Italians, but that doesn't temper what is actually probably quite a cynical view. Would you agree?
I think Italy is a bittersweet country. And the only way in which to approach it or to write about it is in a bittersweet fashion, because it's a country that in a way has an excess of humanity. It has all the good to an excessive degree. It has all the bad to an excessive degree. And I think it's only by that mixture of, if you like, sweet and sour that you can get at the true feel of the place.
I have to say, I mean, if we kind of pick through some of the instances and examples that you've chosen, I mean, it's kind of a plethora of different instances of Italianness. There's one bit you point to, the Vodafone service called Alter Ego, which allows for subscribers to have two phone numbers on the same SIM. And then jumping from that to, you know, some of the great writers or painters of the Renaissance and beyond, maybe kind of illustrate some of the kind of bits of research that you must have done and the conversations that you had with Italians. You know, how did you try and gather it? What was your kind of day-to-day work on the book?
In a way, the book is a distillation of all the years that I've spent in Italy. And a lot of the anecdote is not anecdote that I went out deliberately to get. It's not reportage. It's simply the recording of things that have happened to me along the way, combined with a certain amount of original research specifically for the subjects that I tackled. In many cases, I did search out research papers, look for statistics in order to get at the truth behind things. And sometimes I was very surprised by what I discovered. For example, one of the stereotypes about Italy is that it's crime-ridden because of the mafia. Well, actually, if you look at the statistics, and admittedly we're talking about reported crime, and in parts of Italy there is a greater reluctance to report crime. I mean, violent crime is actually 1/8 of the level that it is in England and Wales. And that, for example, came as a great surprise to me, that there was this image of a country where the shotgun ruled. In fact, though, you've got to look at that stereotype and say, well, yeah, but it's true that the mafia does exist and that there are large parts of this Western European country where control of the territory is not in the hands of the legitimately constituted authority, but in that of the self-constituted authority of the local mafia.
Another kind of prime kind of observation or something that's a thread throughout the book is the image the Italians have of themselves. And this is another perhaps stereotype, that the very smartly or perhaps overdressed Italian, that's a kind of key thread perhaps through a lot of the book. What do you think is the kind of the bottom of that? I mean, is it the cultural connotations of the artistic history of the country? Is it something else? Is it, you know, maybe explain to us what you feel is behind that deep association Italians have with the image.
Well, first of all, let me make my own exception, which is that, you know, there are plenty of kids in Italy who go out looking like kids who are, you know, in squats the world over, kids who live in these so-called centri sociali, which are organized and long-standing squats. They do not form part of that stereotype, but it's certainly true that middle-class Italians, people with the money to buy the high fashion, are incredibly smartly dressed. And I was talking to a friend recently, a French woman who has lived for quite some time in Milan, and she said that what really got her was the newness of the shoes worn by men in Milan. And she said you'd see somebody walking towards you with these beautifully polished new shoes, and then you'd look at what he was carrying, and what was it? A shoe bag. So, yeah, there is this emphasis on appearance, looking good, tied up with the concept of bella figura, which is not just all about appearance, but it's partly about that. So, yeah, there is that. And why? I think partly, yes, it is a visual sense, a visual sensibility that you can trace back to the Renaissance masters. I think Italians do have an instinctive feel for the what goes together. But at the same time, I think it also reflects a certain insecurity in the country. And that is one of the themes of the book. I begin talking about Italy's history and how, on the one hand, it's made up of these glories, the three R's, the Roman Empire, the Renaissance, and the Risorgimento, the process that led up to unification, great periods of their history. But in between, there's the centuries that foreigners just ignore, they don't know about, centuries of fragmentation and vulnerability in the north and of oppression and subjugation to foreigners in the south. Italians, like Irish and Poles, come from a country, part of which, large part of which, was colonized by other Europeans. And I think there's always this tension in the Italian psyche between great pride in the achievements of Rome, of the Renaissance, and of their independence leaders, but on the other side, a feeling of, it's a kind of superiority-inferiority tension, and it's always close to the surface.
That was the writer John Hooper talking a little earlier about his new book, The Italians. He was chatting with Monocle's David Pleasant. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, 10 minutes before the top of the hour. Time for our daily arts review. We're talking music, because it's Tuesday, with the man with the golden and, I must say, somewhat hairy ears. It's Monocle's own Paul Noble.
Hi, Tom.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. Now, we've got some artists. Well, it's kind of interesting. Returns, evolutions of artists that we're going to be talking about in a minute. But first of all, we're going to talk about some artists who have shuffled off this mortal coil. Some people we've lost from the world. So a couple of real titans on the scene, actually.
Two sad deaths this week. One is Edgar Froese, who was, the main part of Tangerine Dream, who did these colossal epic synthesizer tracks, mainly played live, and which, you know, spun off into inspiring all sorts of electronic and techno artists. He died on the 20th of January, age 70. But 2 days ago, on the 25th, Demis Roussos died, the Greek singer, and everyone will know his sort of massive novelty hit Forever and Ever. But he had a glorious career before that. He had a big disco track called L-O-V-E, Got a Hold on Me, in 1978. But what I particularly love him for was the Greek supergroup Aphrodite's Child.
And this was Vangelis, of course, who, again, we're talking about synths, you know, took that to a new level, scoring movies, this kind of thing all through the 80s. But
don't start me off on Vangelis.
The proving ground was in Aphrodite's Child, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they wrote three albums and then split up. And the third one is just a mammoth rock album called 666. And from it, we'll just have a little taster of probably their best track, The Four Horsemen.
That's not a bad testament, is it?
The third one is a black. The last one is a green. I mean, the drums on that, you can't really get any bigger than that.
No, it's great stuff.
It's enormous.
A fitting tribute. Good, nice pick there, Paul Noble.
Thank you. Well, let's get into our three tunes.
Yeah, what are we going to start with? Now, this is, Pete Doherty. I don't know, where do people stand on Pete Doherty? I'm not an enthusiast.
No, I mean...
Let me lay my card squarely on the table.
No, I mean, he has musical talent and he has a way with words, but this is always been overshadowed by his behaviour, and he's just, you know, he's got terrible addiction problems, which he's very open about. And that's, you know, most of the time has just hindered his career massively, and he seems to court trouble wherever he goes.
Tell me a little bit then about what he's come up with now, because he does seem to always turn up like a bad penny. But has he delivered? Because, you know, it's hard to argue with the fact that every now and again there'll be something really pretty stellar.
I mean, he's incredibly prolific given his situation. He's done two albums with the Libertines, three with Baby Shambles, and one solo album, and two books of poetry. And his latest thing is a track for and about Amy Winehouse, who is his friend. It's produced by Stephen Street, who's probably most famous for his work with Blur. And it's the strings are arranged by John Metcalf from Jerita Column, so it's quite a massive provenance. And all the proceeds from the single go to the Amy Winehouse Foundation. Let's have a listen.
Let's have it right. We all know the score. Up for three nights, stuck behind the door. chewing off your jaw. The fame that stoned you with, you soldiered it and made your fortune, but you're broke inside. I don't wanna die anymore. Any more than I did wanna die before.
So Paul, that was Flags of the Old Regime, Pete Doherty. I still can't quite get into that.
But you can't get over your problem with him.
It's moved you, that one.
Kind of reminds me of the late John Lennon, sort of late period, where he was getting really emotional and confessional and very vulnerable. And yeah, I think that's a lovely, lovely song.
Raw emotion. It's too much raw emotion for
you
me,
you can't
Paul.
Take it.
Let's move on. Well, let's move on to another interesting sort of career trajectory, a few ups and downs. Bjork. What's she been up to?
She's back. And it was the release of this album. This is her ninth album. And it's a very personal and intimate album. Usually she talks about much bigger and sort of metaphysical ideas. And this is actually about her breakup. So clearly inspired by Taylor Swift's, you know, very confessional. It's not inspired by Taylor Swift. she's talking about her breakup with her partner, artist Matthew Barney. And just like the Madonna album in December, they've done a sudden rush release on it because the entire thing got leaked by some nincompoop who obviously was part of the creative process and thought they'd stick the whole album out. So it was rushed out on iTunes. And it's a very strong and personal album. She, you know, she can drift off into, you know, pretty unlistenable territory. This is a bit more, you know, songs, lyrics, not just sonic experimentation.
So there's a kind of coherence. Let's have a bit of a listen. Which track are we going to hear?
Oh, now you're asking.
Could it be Stone Milker?
That's the one.
Let's take a listen. Paul, that was Stone Milker from Volnicura from Bjork. I like the sound of that one. We're almost out of time. You're going to play us one more track in a second, but I'll just thank our Midori House production crew today. Our producer, Ben Ryland, researchers David Pleasant and Alia Masood, and our studio manager, Bill Lutie. Section D's following this programme. But Paul, we're going to close the show with a track. Just tell us a little bit about Jared Lawson. This is what you're going to play for us. Tell us a little bit about him, first of all.
So Jared Lawson, he's from Redwood City in California. He's now based in Portland. He's been around. He's played with all sorts of neo-soul artists, Jill Scott and so on. And like someone like Amp Fiddler, he's watched all these people and then thought, hang on, I could do that. So he's a dynamite keyboard player. There's touches of Chick Corea and Oscar Peterson and the sort of very rhythmic jazz pianists in there. But he's also a great singer. There's soul and jazz and Latin and blues. And how's this for a hallmark? He played at Stevie Wonder's birthday party.
That's not bad, is it?
Quite an intimidating gig, I would imagine.
Well, let's close the show then with a track. What are we going to hear?
This one's called, it's the opening track on the album. It's called Music and It's Magical. No, Magical Way.
Welcome. Welcome. Yo, what's up, world? We are the good people. We invite you to join us on this musical journey through space and time and the music of my mind. We're out to change the world one song at a time, y'all. Come along for the ride.